Okay, Proverbs chapter 20. Proverbs 20. And we are down at verse number 13. And we'll go ahead and we'll go to the word in prayer, and then we will dive on in. Dear Lord, we come to you today. Thank you for your blessings. And we do just thank you so much for this time that we have together in church. And we thank you for your word that's before us, Lord, the truth that it contains. And we just pray, ask you that you would just help us as we take these truths to apply them to our hearts and our lives, Lord. I just pray that you would just help me as I teach to make things clear. And Lord, I just pray you be with this church, that we can be a light and a witness here. Pray, Lord, that you please be with all of our church family, Lord, and the different things they've got going on. I know we've got several traveling. I pray you watch over them. And Lord, I just pray that you'd be with Longford Town, that we can be a witness to them, and that you would just work in a mighty way here to draw folks to you, Lord. We just thank you so much for all that you do. In Jesus' name I pray, and amen. Okay, Proverbs 20 and verse 13, we'll just dive right in. Verse 13 says, "Love not sleep, lest thou come to poverty. Open thine eyes, and thou shalt be satisfied with bread." And considering that we're outnumbered by teenagers tonight, maybe this is a good version or a good verse to start with.
Yeah.
We'll continue so you're done yawning. Okay. Let me read my verse again. "Love not sleep, lest thou come to poverty. Open thine eyes, and thou shalt be satisfied with bread." Just ironically, eat too much bread, it makes you sleepy. But anyway, we better get into the Bible. Solomon has said several things throughout the book of Proverbs, challenging us to steer clear of laziness. And I've said in the past that I don't think that Solomon could have been a lazy guy. He had a lot going on. If nothing else, 700 wives would keep him busy. He probably didn't get much sleep. Right? In verse 4, we saw that excuses and a desire for comfort will result in poverty, and in the end will result in greater discomfort. A little bit of comfort and convenience now is going to be very inconvenient later on. And so now he's going to tackle indulgence. There's no doubt that sleep is a necessity, right? And so he's not telling us to not sleep, because that would wreck our bodies. We have to rest. And so sleep is a necessity. It is a good thing. Having adequate rest is being a good steward of the body that God has given us. If we don't get adequate rest, then we're going to wreak havoc on our body. We're going to have trouble concentrating, all kinds of things. We're going to be a poor worker if we don't get adequate rest. But just with every good thing, if you take it in excess, it becomes a bad thing. And so our times of rest and inactivity are meant to be restorative, so that we are able to be more productive and to make a good use out of our waking hours. Ephesians chapter 5, verses 15 and 16, that I refer to quite frequently, says, "See then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time, for the days are evil." And so whenever we look at this idea of walking circumspectly, redeeming the time, it lets us know that we need to make a good use of the time that we have. And so that means that we sleep whenever it's time to sleep, and we work whenever it's time to work, and then we enjoy the fruits of our labors after we have labored. And so there is an order to things as well, because if we do what we need to now, we can enjoy the benefits and the fruits of it later on. But if we resist doing what we need to now, then we're never going to see those fruits come about, okay? And so then we have Ecclesiastes chapter number 5. And we know that Ecclesiastes, written by Solomon, was his search basically for the meaning of life, trying to find out what it was supposed to be all about, because he had everything that a man could want, still wasn't happy, right? But in Ecclesiastes 5, verses 18 and 19, it says, "Behold that which I have seen. It is good and comely for one to eat and to drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor that he taketh under the sun, and all the days of his life which God giveth him, for it is his portion. Every man also to whom God hath given riches and wealth, and hath given him power to eat thereof and to take his portion and to rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God." And so we don't usually think of work and of labor being a gift of God until you're not able to do it, right? And if you can't work and you can't labor, then it's going to take away a sense of accomplishment. It's going to take away an ability. It's going to take away of or take away our ability to take care of ourselves. It's going to take away our independence and cause us to be dependent or be desolate. And so labor in and of itself is a good thing. By the way, something that we often don't realize is labor isn't part of the curse, because Adam labored before sin. He labored before the fall. God told him, go forth, dress, and keep the garden. He gave him a work to do, because a person without a purpose is going to be miserable. And we have plenty of research that leads to the knowledge that sedentary lifestyles and lives without any kind of work, anything that brings a sense of fulfillment or purpose to our lives, brings about depression, brings about all kinds of other mental health issues. Okay? And so whenever we find here that he says, love not sleep, lest thou come to poverty, open your eyes, and thou shalt be satisfied with bread, he's saying work is a good thing. To whenever it comes time to get up, go to work, earn your wages, earn your bread, and then rejoice in those and be able to enjoy the fruits of your labor, the benefits of the health and the abilities and the body and the vitality that God has given you. Okay? And if you choose rest and comfort without labor, don't be surprised whenever you find yourself in want. Okay, so any comments or anything about that verse? Okay, verse number 14. Verse 14 says, it is not, saith the buyer, but when he is going his way, then he boasteth. And so this is somewhat of a funny verse, because this is a picture of a business deal going down. So the guy goes into the shop. You can imagine a Middle Eastern bazaar or something. The guy goes and he's looking at something. For some reason, the opening scenes of Aladdin come to mind. Right? You remember the scene where the guy's there? Okay. So comes to the bazaar and there's an item that he wants. And in the Middle Eastern culture, there was always haggling that went on. And so the owner of the wares would give a high price with the expectation that the buyer is going to offer a low price, and then they're going to go back and forth and haggle, and they enjoy that kind of thing. That's not something that we're as accustomed to. There are some places where we would still do that. I've done my share of it, especially with buying and selling cars and stuff like that. If you go in and they have a price, but you're not going to pay the asking price, you've got to haggle a little bit. And so in verse number 14, it is not. He's saying it's not good. It's nothing. It's of little value. And so he's trying to make out as if whatever item he's getting ready to buy isn't any good, so he can get it at a lower price. So we're familiar with that, right? And so he keeps bringing out all the flaws, all the imperfections. If I was buying a car, it's like, oh, look, it's dinged here, and this isn't working, and I'm going to have to fix this, and, well, the tires aren't real good, and it's going to need a brake job, and so we need to come down on that price, because look at all these problems that I'm going to have to deal with as soon as I get it. And so we get the price down, and they go away and say, oh, I got a deal on that one. So that was the idea, is whenever it's got all these problems, there's all these things wrong with it, and then at the end of the verse, when he is going his way, then he boasteth. And so whenever he owns it, it's the greatest thing ever. But whenever he's trying to buy it, it's a piece of junk. Okay? And so that's what's going on there. So a buyer depreciates the value of an item trying to get the best deal. The seller talks up the item trying to make the most profit. And so that's the other side of it, is looking at all of the positives to it. You know, bringing out all the different good qualities. We're still talking about cars, right? And so you're talking about the car. It's like, well, I've done this and I've put these parts on it and it just had this done to it. And I've taken good care of it. And I've owned it for this long. And so it's such a good car. It's worth this money, right? And so the whole back and forth. And so it's the same item. It's got the same qualities, but there's different motives behind either one. And basically, they're looking out for themselves in each time. And they're not necessarily looking at what's right. Okay? Because the seller wants to feel as if he got a fair price. And the buyer wants to feel like he got a good deal. And whenever they can come to where both of them feel good about, they sell it, right? Mm-hmm. But anyway, really this verse is a rebuke of dishonesty and manipulation. We can see that, right? Mm-hmm. You're trying to do business, and rather than being selfish about it, rather than saying, okay, it's all about me and I've got to make sure I get a good deal, it's, okay, we're doing a business transaction. Okay? We need to do what's fair, what's right, not necessarily what can I get over on them or how can I cheat them out of something. Mm-hmm. Because there is a lot of times that mentality of trying to cheat the other person, trying to feel like somehow you had one up on the other person. And that's not the best way to go about doing things, is it? So it's a rebuke of dishonesty and manipulation. And we are to be just in our dealings. It's only right to seek a fair price that all parties are happy with it. So it's not that you just go and get cheated, but you need to be equitable about it. You need to be just in dealings. It's not right to take advantage of someone in business. And that might not be the most exciting verse or the most exciting thing to look at, but I think it has further applications as well. Because if you go beyond business, a person is going to value what they have at a far greater rate than valuing what you have. Okay? And so if we apply this further than just buying and selling, if I have a talent or ability, it's something wonderful. If you have it, right? If you're offering up something, so what? But if I'm offering up something even less, it's something great. We've all seen that, right? And so we see this inequity amongst people whenever they are judging themselves and judging other people. We make less of others to make ourselves feel better. Others will make less of us to make themselves feel better. Sometimes we get caught up in other people's opinions and what other people are saying, not realizing that there is this inequity in the way that they're evaluating. We often take other people's opinions at a heavier weight than what we should. Okay? Because whenever we understand the way that the human mind works, they are going to deprecate the things that other people have to bring to the table, the other things that people have to offer. Okay? Take, for instance, going for a job. Okay, I am so fitted for this job. I'm going to be such an asset to this company. I can do all of these things, and you just see yourself as a shining example. Someone with the exact same qualifications can come there, and you're like, yeah, they wouldn't be a good fit. They're not any good for this, right? Because whenever I have it, it's something great. When you have it, who cares? And I'm saying that tongue in cheek. I'm not saying that that's how I'm actually thinking. I'm saying that's how people actually do conduct themselves oftentimes. So if we understand that they're going to devalue what you have so that they can gain advantage, whether it's your talents or your looks or your possessions or whatever you have, people will devalue that to try to bring themselves to an advantage. And so that should cause us to not take their valuations, their criticisms, their critiques so harshly, right? And so we're critical of others, we're gracious with self, and if we factor this into our interactions, we're going to be a lot better off. And it can also help us to change our own interaction so this isn't true for us, so that we aren't cutting other people down to advance ourselves, so that we're not looking at others and saying, it is not. Okay? So, any comments or anything to add to that? Okay. Verse number 15. Just cruising right along. It says, there is gold and a multitude of rubies, but the lips of knowledge are a precious jewel. True wealth consists of what money can't buy. Yes. That's an easy enough takeaway from that, right? Mm-hmm. But the way this proverb is written, it is letting us know that there's plenty of gold out there. There's plenty of rubies out there. There's jewelry. There's, you know, gems, all of this. And imagine Solomon, the richest guy in the world. He's like, yeah, I've got all of that stuff. But what I have trouble finding is a person who uses knowledge rightly. A person who is able to speak with knowledge, with wisdom, with understanding. He's saying that is a rare jewel indeed. Yes, I've got piles of silver and of gold and of precious stones, but what is really precious is wisdom and knowledge used aright. And so the lips of knowledge means that the head knows, the heart understands, and the mouth can communicate. Takes all three, right? If a person has a head knowledge, but it never actually goes into his life and the way that he lives and the way that he acts, if it's never actually appropriated, does that head knowledge do him any good? No. If he has the head knowledge and he has the ability to apply it to his life, but he has no way to convey it to someone else, does it do anyone good besides him? No. And see how this is getting more and more rare? How it's more and more of a skill? And so whenever he says here, the lips of knowledge are a precious jewel. He's saying whenever a person it has the knowledge, has the understanding, is able to convey it and communicate it so that others may benefit from it, that is something that is entirely precious. And Solomon was known to have wisdom above every man that ever walked the face of the earth, basically. That people would travel from all over the world just to listen to the wisdom that he had. And so he was truly a precious jewel in that, right? But I don't think that he was exalting himself. But he's looking around. Maybe this is a bad thing to say, but could you imagine how discouraging, disappointing it would be to be the smartest man? I've heard it said before that if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. Because no one has anything to offer you, right? And I don't mean that in an arrogant way or a selfish way, but we should be looking for ways that we can grow, that we can increase, that we can gain, and that there is some kind of interaction that we can take, right? If you're the smartest person in the room, then no one there is able to share anything with you, right? They're not able to feed into you to help you. And basically what ends up happening if you're the smartest person in the room is that you're there out of pride and arrogance usually. Usually. But whenever we look at Solomon, he was always the smartest guy in the room because of how smart that he was. And so I can imagine as he's looking around and he's saying, lips of knowledge are truly as a precious jewel. He's saying, I can't find anyone who can teach me anything. I can't find anyone that I can learn anything from. I can't find anyone who's able to. And it's not because that no one else was wise, but because of how far up he was, right? And the reason I'm saying all of this is that the smarter a person becomes, the more difficult it is. I'm trying not to say this in a coarse way. It's harder to put up with everybody else's stupidity. Is that a bad way to put it? Because Solomon said with much knowledge is much, something to the line of much grief as well. And so anyway, whenever we're looking at the ability to understand and communicate knowledge, it's information that's fully digested and fully dispersed as well. And that's what makes it rare. Bringing this into the context of previous two verses, wisdom is worth waking up for and laboring to get. Okay? And then laboring with the hands and laboring with the mind. Going out and actually getting this and valuing this. Then not devaluing or bargain hunting when it comes to knowledge and wisdom. Going after that which is easy. going after that which is cheap, which is easily accessed. You may be able to scheme your way to golden rubies, but wisdom is going to come at a price. Those who have it know its worth, and you'll be wise to pay whatever price you have to in order to obtain it. Okay, putting in the time, the efforts, the labors to get the knowledge, get the wisdom. Time, effort, sacrifice, study, they're all small prices to pay in order to obtain real wisdom. And then once you have it, it's going to pay dividends, right? Because wisdom is an investment, isn't it? You get it, to give it, to get it, to give it, to increase, to grow, to benefit. Not only that, but whenever you have wisdom, it's not just a possession that you have, but it is giving you direction and ability in life. You are learning and applying it so that you can go forward, that you can grow, that you can increase. And as you're doing that, you're also avoiding the pitfalls and the dangers and the troubles that the fool faces. Because if we look through the book of Proverbs, you have the fool, you have the scorner, right? And the trouble that they fall into whenever they're not after wisdom. And so anyway, in this verse, there is gold and a multitude of rubies. Yes, it's out there. Yes, you can get it. But if you really want to know what's important, the lips of knowledge are a precious jewel. They're not going to lose value. You don't have to worry about the markets crashing, right? You don't have to worry about not getting a return on your investment whenever you are pursuing after knowledge and the understanding and the use of knowledge. Okay? So any questions or comments on verse 15?
But anyway, you know how you were saying knowledge was in the head, heart, and the ability to be able to get it out correctly. Do you think that's a gift?
I think some people have a greater aptitude for it, a greater ability for it than others do. But I would be careful of looking at it as something that some people have and some people don't, because if you look at it that way, then you assume that you're the one who doesn't, and then you never actually pursue after it.
Yeah. No, I was thinking more Melody's. I was thinking more of actually everybody does have it, but it's kind of like faith. The more you use it, the more you exercise it, the greater it becomes. And so I just wondered, I mean, it's just a thought, but I just personally, that way, I do feel, or I personally think that communicating is a gift for some people.
Well, and then if you get into spiritual gifts, for instance.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, if you get into spiritual gifts, then obviously there are certain gifts that are gifts of communication.
Yeah.
Okay. You take the gift of evangelism, for instance.
Yeah.
Okay. There's some are evangelists. Those are people who have a divine ability that's given to them to share the gospel clearly in a way that points people to Christ, and they're going to see people saved. I believe the greatest example of the gift of evangelists would be the Apostle Paul. He could come to a town, preach the gospel, see hundreds or thousands of people saved, right? He had that gifting. We find Timothy probably didn't. Okay. Paul still said, do the work of an evangelist. But Timothy was the one that came in behind to do the discipling after Paul left. And so I'd say Timothy probably had the gift of prophecy. And the gift of prophecy isn't, okay, you're going to win the lottery or the numbers.
All right.
It's not, you know, fortune telling. Okay. Because in the Bible, predominantly what you have with the prophets was proclaiming God's message.
Right.
Okay? We confuse foretelling and forthtelling. But the majority of what the prophets did was just telling God's message. What God's message was revealed, telling it, make it clear to the people. And so whenever we talk about the gift of prophecy, that's being able to explain God's word and be able to make it clear. So it'd be a very much like the teaching gift. I guess prophecy is typically more toward preaching. It'd be the proclaiming of judgment and that which is ahead. Okay? Because that's what prophets did. And you have the gift of teaching, making God's word clear. And so these are communicating gifts, but they have their own flavor, if you will. And so this comes back to diversity. Everybody has differing abilities, but everybody has ability. Okay? And so with what you're saying with communicating, even though God gives the gifts and the abilities, I believe it's something that we have to practice, that we have to do, and have to perfect in a way, rather than just being satisfied with where we're at. Because a lot of what we're reading in Proverbs is pursuing after, is desiring a greater ability, greater interest in things. Another thing that popped in my mind as you were saying that too was where it says in the Bible, if any man lack wisdom, let him ask of God, who giveth liberally and upbraideth not.
Yes.
And the idea behind that is, okay, I'm lacking wisdom. There's something that I'm needing here. And so I'm going to go to God and I'm going to ask for it.
Yeah.
Okay? And it talks about not doubting, but to ask in faith.
Yeah.
Okay? And so the idea with that is, okay, I'm asking, but it's not that God's just going to, like lightning bolt from heaven, bam, you have it.
Right.
Because have you ever prayed for wisdom? Right? Anyone pray for wisdom? The Bible instructs us to, right? Okay. And so it's not that God's just like gives you a lightning bolt from heaven. It's not like some kind of a huge experiential moment or whatnot. And the Bible doesn't promise that. But whatever we ask, we're to ask in faith, believing that we're going to receive it. So the idea is, okay, by faith, I'm going to go forward, trusting that God's given me the wisdom in this situation. Okay? And so that's where faith and wisdom, faith and knowledge come together, is trusting in God, exercising that faith, exercising that wisdom. And with that, you're going to grow, you're going to increase in it as you depend on God for it. So he gives it to us as we need it. Okay? Dave, that makes sense. Some of it. Okay. Anything else? Okay, verse number
16.
Oh, okay. Just make sure you're paying attention. Okay, verse 16. Take his garment that is surety for a stranger, and take a pledge of him for a strange woman. Anyone want to take a stab at this one? This might be interesting. Okay. Verse number 16. Take his garment that is surety for a stranger, and take a pledge of him for a strange woman. Is yours quite a bit different?
Yeah.
What does it say?
Take the garment for one who puts up security for a stranger. Hold it in pledge if it is done for an outsider.
Okay.
Where's the strange woman part?
Yeah, so a woman.
Okay. Well,
Okay, I'll take a stab. So it says, take the garment for one, so basically someone who would help a stranger. Mm-hmm. And then it says, hold it if it is done for an outsider. So basically like a guarantor type situation,
mm-hmm.
which is if someone is willing to say they would do something for the other, hold something of value to them.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to basically fulfill their promise.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I hear.
Okay. Now, I just going back for just a second with the whole part about the strange woman, okay? The word for woman is in the originals.
Mm-hmm.
So it's supposed to be there. But anyway.
Because if it is woman, it's a little bit different. I feel like that gives a slightly different
there, context. That was payment for something.
Because I'm thinking of the story where the woman... is her husband dies,
mm-hmm.
and
her
yeah,
pregnant,
yeah, and she
month.
Had
mm-hmm.
the
staff and the
ring, mm-hmm.
so,
the ensign, yeah.
Yeah, so that gives a slightly different context to if it's like a stranger.
Well, she wasn't a strange woman.
She
was his daughter-in-law.
Yeah,
yeah, but it was kind of same essence where it was held as evidence that mm-hmm. this person had promised to do mm-hmm. this thing.
Yeah, I'll pay mm-hmm. you back.
Yeah.
I owe you.
So insurance almost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So whenever we look at the, I want to look back at the, okay, the two words that was used is surety and pledge. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so both of those are means of standing good for a debt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And a key in this passage, in this verse, says, take his garment that is surety for a stranger. So we have three people in that passage. Okay. And so I am the one who is loaning out. I'm loaning out to a third party. And someone else is going to stand good for their debt.
Yeah.
Now, whenever it says that they are strange, it could have two different meanings, which basically end up being about the same thing. Okay? So in a biblical context, someone who's strange is either going to be someone who's unknown to you or someone that's unknown to your people. Because the stranger is often the Gentile, the pagan, the outsider, the non-Jew. Okay? And so the idea here is, if someone is foolish enough to stand good for a debt of someone they don't know, they don't know their character, they don't know their if they can trust them. Not only that, if it's a stranger to the nation of Israel, they are playing by a different set of rules. Okay? They're not playing by the Jews' moral code. They're going to have their own. And so if you are going to stand good for the debt of someone who holds different values, someone whose values are unknown to you, someone that you don't know, then you're foolish, right? And so what this verse says is, if someone is foolish enough to do that, don't feel bad taking their stuff. Okay? And that might sound a little harsh or a little bit cruel, right? So if I'm the lender and you two don't know each other, but Shakimi stands good for Emily's debt. She says, hey, if she doesn't pay, I'll pay for it. I'll put up the usury. You can borrow it on my house or my car or whatever. Okay? Well, that would be dumb. Because you don't know her. And so what if she doesn't pay? She has no skin in the game now. The only thing that she has is her honor, basically. And if she is an unhonorable person, then she can just walk away and you're left on the hook. And then whenever I come calling in the debt, you stood good for her debt, and I take your usury for her debt, she goes off smiling and you're the one crying. And then if I'm a compassionate person, I feel sorry for you and I hate to take your stuff. Okay? But it says in verse 16, take his garment, that is surety for a stranger, and take the pledge of him for a strange woman. And if you want to take the strange woman part of that and say, okay, he is going out there and foolishly putting himself out there for a harlot or whatever, basically they need to get the consequences of their foolishness. You're doing someone no favor by taking pity on them and keeping the consequences off of them. Okay? And so that comes to a whole bigger lesson for us as well. Because if we are not careful, we can be enablers of people's bad decisions, their bad actions, by trying to shield them from the consequences. And consequences come for a reason. Right? Now, I will say there's a place for compassion. There's a place for mercy when someone learns from their mistakes, when someone sees their mistakes, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying that you just say, hey, you had it coming to you and you're completely heartless. But I believe what we're seeing in this verse is, don't have compassion for the fool, because how will the fool ever learn if his mistakes don't hurt?
Okay.
And so if the businessman runs into such a fool, take his pledge or his surety so that he can learn through consequence. He will learn a valuable lesson. It'll be far greater for him to do something stupid and learn a lesson from it than to do something stupid and escape consequence and continue in foolishness. Okay? And so it comes back to the old saying that I use oftentimes, that stupid should hurt. Okay? And this is a bit of a foreign concept today because there is so much effort to take consequences away from people. We look at the justice system and people do heinous, egregious things and never actually face any real justice or consequence for it, and they continue onward, right? Parents do the best they can to shield their children from the consequences of their actions and from bad decisions. And their children continue in bad behavior, right? And so there comes to a time whenever a fool needs to get a fool's reward. And so I think Solomon is basically saying, I have no patience. I have no sympathy for someone who does something so foolish. So if you put up surety for a stranger, for a strange woman, that was dumb. Sorry about your loss. Moving onward. Right? Okay. Any other comments or anything on that verse? Probably a bunch. Okay, verse 17. Bread of deceit is sweet to a man, but afterward his mouth shall be filled with gravel. Okay? So bread of deceit is ill-gotten gain. Mm-hmm. Things that are gotten by scheming and by graft, and they're going to seem sweet at the time. Look at what I got. But the problem is later on you find out, look what I lost. And that's the way that things tend to happen. As the man is making bank, he's bankrupting his soul. And then the old saying, we reap what we sow, but the harvest always comes later and it comes in abundance. We reap later than we sow and we reap more than we sow. And so that's whenever later on, what was sweet becomes gravel in his mouth. And I think the classic example is Ebenezer Scrooge. I already tried to get stuck into Christmas there, so I might as well bring him up. So Ebenezer Scrooge had amassed much wealth by cruelty and taking advantage of other people. And though he was wealthy, he was alone, he was hated, and he was miserable. And it took him a little while to wake up, but whenever he realized what his selfishness and his greed was going to cost him, that was a wake-up call for him, wasn't it? That's whenever everything changed around because he realized he was going to be dying, he was going to be alone, and no one was even going to mourn him because of the way that he lived his life. And that became a bitter pill for him to swallow. Another example is Judas. No doubt that 30 pieces of silver was quite appealing whenever he first received it. But then by the time it was all over, he was trying to do the best he could to get rid of it. And he actually threw it down in the temple and he ran away from it because he saw the consequences of his actions, right? And so once again, we're being brought back to consequence, right? And so gaining the wrong way takes the enjoyment out of it. It brings guilt and shame. It hurts relationships. It hurts reputation. And if conscience and community doesn't hold us accountable, one day God does. And so even if a person gets off scot-free in this life, he will not in eternity because ultimately he answers to God. So you think about the people who make their millions, if you will, by corrupt means, and it looks like they're living it up. Granted, most of them aren't. Some of the wealthiest people are the most miserable. And that goes right along with this verse. But even if they can get through life unscathed, at the end of this life, they still have to give an account to God. And from everything that I read in Scripture, God does not take well whenever people get through deceit, and by mistreating of less fortunate people, right? And so they will be accountable before God. Okay, any comments on that verse? Okay, verse number 18 then. And this will be our last one. Every purpose is established by counsel, and with good advice make war. I think a king would be prone to acts of pride and foolishness, especially a young one. Often it's the young and the inexperienced that possess the greatest confidence. Have you ever noticed that? Age humbles and has a way of mellowing people oftentimes. And I was talking, I think, with one of my girls the other day about different psychological phenomena. And there's something called the Dunning-Kruger effect. Have you heard of it? Okay. Basically, the Dunning-Kruger effect is the more ignorant someone is, the more confident they are. And the more knowledgeable they get, the less they are confident. And there is they actually have it graphed out a way that it works. And so your confidence, okay, if we were to graph it, your knowledge on this axis, your confidence on this axis. So you start off, your confidence is high, your knowledge is low. And as your knowledge increases, your confidence goes down. And it finally bottoms out and it eventually starts increasing again. Okay? And that's kind of how things go. And the reason I bring that out is Solomon was getting ready to turn his kingdom over to his foolish son. He's talking to his son. He's trying to tell him, you don't know as much as you think you do. You're going to need counsel. You're going to need guardrails. You're going to need people watching out for you. You're going to need people that's calling out your blind spots and your folly, and you're going to have to be able to take that counsel into yourself. Because if you don't have that, you're going to flame out in a major way, which is what he ended up doing. And so whenever he says every purpose is established by counsel, the idea of being established is to be made firm, to be steadfast, okay? You can have something stable, something secure. As you're making your plans, as you're laying out your future, as you're casting your vision, you can make it firm and steadfast through counsel. But a lot of times we are just kind of winging it as we go along, depending on our own abilities, depending on our own intellect, our own hopes and dreams and wishes and emotions. And we find out real quick that there's things that we hadn't anticipated. There's things that we hadn't foreseen. There are challenges that arise that if we would have simply talked to someone, they could have pointed out ahead of time. Okay? And so if we were wise, we'll not overestimate our wisdom or our abilities, because our desires and our emotions often blind us to our weaknesses, and also it blinds us to flaws that are in our plans. We start off in something optimistic, and this is something that my girls know all too well here, is they come out with plans, they bring them to me, and then I shoot holes in them. And they tell me I'm a fun sucker. I'm a killjoy. Because I'm seeing things that they haven't allowed for, things that they were blinded to, right? Have you considered this? What about this? Right? But as uncomfortable as that is, it's even more uncomfortable to charge headlong into the middle of something and then get met by something extremely difficult, extremely hard, that was preventable. Okay? And so our desires, our emotions blind us to our weaknesses and our flaws and our plans. But the way that we overcome this is by counsel, by consulting with those who have differing perspectives, different experiences, different expertise, right? Sometimes it's a good idea just to go to someone who's been there before, who's had experience, who knows what they're doing. You know, raising kids. Hey, I've got this going on. And I'm like, yeah, I know what that's like. I went through it before. Okay, how did you navigate it? Well, I did it this way, but I messed up. You might want to avoid these things that I did. Good to know, because I was going to try that. Okay? And so whenever we're consulting those with different perspectives and different experiences, we're made aware of problems before they were problems, and we learn better ways that we never even thought of, never even considered. After counsel, we can proceed with more confidence, having a better understanding that our way is going to go well, and being prepared for things ahead of time before they appear. Because it's not just avoiding all of it, it's being ready for some of it as well. Okay, for instance, you're getting ready to move, you're getting ready to go to another country. It's like, okay, I really need to be talking to people who are over on that side, people who've done this before, and getting to know what the process is, what kind of paperwork I need, how difficult it's going to be, things to watch out for, things to be aware of, things that are hidden that I never factored in. And it's like, you got to go on a fact-finding mission, right? Before you ever go. So if you just decided, okay, I want to move to Canada, and you just jumped on a plane and went, how's that going to turn out for you? Well, for one thing, you're going to get turned away from the airline, whether they do it on this side or that side. They're going to say, wait a minute, you need a visa first. Didn't know that, should have asked someone. You get your visa, you get over there, it's like, I can't find a place to rent anywhere. How do I get into the housing market? How does that even work over here? I mean, there's just so many different things, and you're well aware of that, right? And so the more counsel that you're getting, the more people that you're pulling from, the smoother the journey is going to be. Okay. The last half of this verse shows the value of counsel whenever we're going to war. And I don't think any of us intend on going to war, right? But we do have to learn how to pick our battles. In times of strife, in times of disagreement, in times of conflict, is whenever we are incredibly susceptible to get ourselves into trouble. And so whenever there are times of conflict, our emotions are going to get up, our minds are going to run wild, we are going to react, right? And we're going to make mistakes. And so whenever it says that, let me see our verse here, with good advice, make war. Whenever there are troubles, whenever there is difficulty, that's when you need to be reaching out and saying, okay, how do I move forward with this? So with a king getting ready to go to war, he needs to go consult his generals. He needs to consult his, you know, his treasurer. He needs to consult, the different avenues that he's got there and say, hey, are we able to do this? Do we have a strong enough army? Do we have big enough stockpiles? Is our morale high enough? Is our treasury strong enough? Can we fund this? Can we fight it? Do we have what we need? Or do we need to approach this a different way? Do we need to send ahead and try to seek terms of peace? Right? Is this battle worth facing? Because you don't want to go fight a war whenever you know that you're going to lose it. And so that's why he's telling this to his son. But whenever it applies to us, it's in times of pressure, in times of heat, in times of conflict, then you better be seeking out advice so that you're not making dumb decisions. So that you're not getting yourself in over your head and getting yourself in a war that you can't win, getting yourself overtaken by the enemies, right? And so we need to have people in our corner. We need to have people by our side. You don't fight a war by yourself. Okay. So any questions or comments on verse 18?
I have a comment there where I think nowadays, especially since we're not kings, nor are we going to war,
mm-hmm.
that is what one of the key roles also of the local church, mm-hmm. where we're supposed to have a diversity of age, a diversity of abilities, where we can learn and gain from the other. And it's really a big blessing that it's so often nowadays that the only people you talk about certain things with are people that are exactly in the same age and stage as you,
mm-hmm.
which means it's like mm-hmm. the blind leading the blind.
Yes.
Where if you are able to connect with people slightly older, people in different walks of life, different seasons, you are able to utilize their experiences to make decisions and exactly like it said, obtain guidance on how to go mm-hmm. about things. So that's really useful as well.
Well, and that's one of the things that the current climate of the world right now, the culture of the world, is pitting group versus group and separating people into their own little groups and ideologies and age brackets and races and, you know, personal experiences and stuff. So there's not any intermixing, and we see each other as enemies instead of as allies, and we're not actually gleaning. So the whole thing that I brought out in the past of pitting generation against generation, where, you know, Gen Z versus millennial versus Gen X versus the boomer, we're not seeing them as a resource, or we're seeing them as an opponent. And that is completely messed up. But then even the way that society has been ordered for a couple centuries now, where there's so much of a segregation by age as children are growing up, you know, the modern school systems and stuff, where you get accustomed for the first 18 years of your life of experiencing life with people at the same age and stage as you for 18 years. And then you go through university, you've got several years above that. And it trains you to only be able to interact with people your own age. And it isolates you from other groups. And that's, I guess, something that probably is played into that. But what we actually find is what you're saying is we need to be learning the older from the younger and the younger from the older, and the you know, the people who's a little further down the line than what you are, they've got things that you can glean. And so I definitely believe the church should be a place. And this is something I've said many times, that unfortunately it's became the norm for everyone to come in and put on a show. You know, you got your mask on, you say the right things, you do the right thing, you don't struggle with anything, you don't have any problems, and you have to act like you have it all together. And that's not the way that it's supposed to be in church. Instead, you're supposed to come together and bear one another's burdens and carry the struggles and instruct one another. And whenever it talks about edifying, that's building up. And you can't build up people if you don't realize, if you can't see that they're still under construction. Right? If we want to come in with our facades looking like we're finished, complete building, we don't need build up. We don't need anything. We've got it all together. That's a mess. Definitely a good thought there. Anything else? Okay, then. We'll stop there.